namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. So, we're continuing our reading in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. We're in chapter 12. And today we're going to, I'll read until we come to the purport, which I think is, we're starting at text 40. And I think we're going to go to 41, 42. So, text 40. Sri Shuddha Uvacha Itang Dijaya. No, this is not. I'm just going to read until we get to the purport, which I think is 42. So I'm just going to read this one by myself. Sri Shuddha Uvacha Itang Dijaya Deva Datta Shutva Saratushtaritang Vichitram Prapacha Bhuyo Pitareva Punyam Vyasakim Yan Nigrihita Chetaha. Sri Sutta Goswami said, O learned saints, the childhood pastimes of Sri Krishna are very wonderful. Maharaj Pariksit, after hearing about those pastimes of Krishna, who had saved him in the womb of his mother, became steady in his mind and again inquired from Shukadev Goswami to hear about those pious activities. Next verse has no purport, so I'll do that myself also. Sri Rajavacha Brahman Kalantara Krittam Tadkali Nankatang Pavet Yat Kaumare Hari Krittam Jagu Pogandakir Bakaha. Maharaj Pariksit inquired, O great sage, how could things done in the past have been described as being done at the present? Lord Sri Krishna performed this pastime of killing Aghasura during his Kaumara age. How then, during his Pauganda age, could these boys have described this incident as having happened recently? So this verse has a purport, so we'll do this responsibly. Tad Bruhi Me Mahayogin Param Kautuhalam Guru Nunam Etad Dhare Eva Maya Bhavati Nanyata Tad Bruhime Mahayogin Param Kautuhalam Guru Nunameta Dharyareva Maya Bhavati Nanyata Tad Bruhime Mahayogin Param Kautuhalam Guru Nunameta Dharyareva Maya Bhavati Nanyata Tad Bruhime Mahayogin Param Kautuhalam Guru Nunam Eta Dharyareva Maya Bhavati Nanyata. Please chant. paranko tu halangro unang intendo yareva maya mavati nanyata paranko tu halangro Nunameta Dharereva Maya Pavatinanyata Vaishnavis Tad Bruhi Me Mahayogin Okay, synonyms, tat bruhi. Therefore, please explain that. May unto me, Mahayogin, O great yogi, param very much, kautuhalam, curiosity, guru, O my Lord, my spiritual master, nunam, otherwise, etat, this incident, harehe, of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, eva, indeed, maya, the illusion, bhavati, becomes, na anyata, nothing more. Srila Prabhupada's translation for this verse, O greatest yogi, my spiritual master, kindly describe why this happened. I am very much curious to know about it. I think that it was nothing but another illusion due to Krishna. Please repeat. O greatest yogi, my spiritual master, kindly describe why this happened. I am very much curious to know about it. I think that it was nothing but another illusion due to Krishna. So, Srila Prabhupada's purport. Krishna has many potencies. Parasya Shaktir Vividaiva Shuyate. This is from the Shvetas Vatara Upanishad. The description of Aghasura was disclosed after 1 year. Some act of Krishna's potency must have been involved. Therefore, Maharaj Parikshit was very curious to know about this, and he requested Shukadeva Goswami to explain it. Ma Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Shivati Bhakta Vedanta Swami Nitinamine. Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Prasuchadishtarne Om Agyana Tamarandasya Agyana Anjana Shalakaya Chakshara Unmulitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Shtapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Sopadantikam Vandeyaham Shri Guru Shri Tapada Kamalam Shri Guru and Vaishnavaksha Shri Rupam Sagajatam Sahagana Ragana Tanvatam Tangsajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parajana Sayatam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Pada Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakanvatangsha He Krishna Karana Sindhu Dina Bando Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namaste Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshri Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priya Vancha Kopaturu Vyasha Kripa Sindhu Meivacha Patitanam Pavane Pyo Vaishnave Pyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasari Gaura Bhaktivedanta Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Who remembers what is the meaning of Parikshit? The examiner, yes. So, Parikshit Maharaj has given that name because, as is mentioned in the previous verse, when he was in the womb of his mother, he was saved by Lord Krishna. Saved from what? Brahmastra thrown by whom? Ashvatam. Yes, Ashutama was trying to put an end to the Pandava dynasty. So Uttara was pregnant. By whom? Abhimanyu. And who's Abhimanyu's father? Arjuna, yes. So the succession coming down, royal succession, and he wanted, because his side, the Kauravas, at that point were obviously losing. They were about to lose the Battle of Kurukshetra. And so this Ashwatthama, although ostensibly a Brahmana, he was actually referred to as Brahma Bandhu, because he was not acting as a Brahmana. He was trying by unfair means, by illegal means, to end the Pandava dynasty. He killed the 5 sleeping children of the Pandavas, and then now he was trying to end the life of this embryo within the womb of Uttara by throwing this Brahmastra. Mentioned there, just like now, we're living in times where nuclear proliferation is going on and the use of nuclear weapons is actually being discussed publicly, that this person in North Korea, he's so over the top that he may push the button, and maybe we should push the button first and take him out, you know, like that. So people are actually discussing, but we know from example of what happened in World War II, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, that they don't have such control over the nuclear weapons nowadays that they did in those times. In those times, it was such a precise science that Ashwatthama could send a nuclear device to kill one embryo in the womb of the mother. Not to kill everybody, destroy, you know, civilization. No. It was such a perfect science. And even though he was Brahma Bandhu, not exactly highest qualified person, still, he knew the science well enough that he could send a Brahmastra, which is an atomic weapon, to kill one embryo in the womb of one woman. That's how precise it was. Now we know, it's being discussed already, again, publicly, that what happens if this guy pushes the button over on his side, and can we prevent all those missiles from coming here, and if one of them landed in Los Angeles, how many people would die, and da-da-da, and vice versa. If they push the button from this side and it goes to Pyongyang, North Korea, how many people would die there, and what would be the reaction, and da-da-da. Not under their control, in other words, simply speculation. By speculation, they've come to a type of atomic weapon, not exactly the type that was being used in 5,000 years ago by the both sides had the technology. But we see, even after so many millions of warriors were died in that battle, still pretty much the society was intact in terms of they didn't destroy all the infrastructure. And nowadays, even with conventional weapons, they have a war, and they destroy the entire infrastructure. So two countries split apart, Sudan becomes Sudan and South Sudan, and they destroy so much infrastructure, and then they have to go begging to the world community for money to rebuild. So why did he destroy it in the first place? Same thing in Syria. This guy won't leave, up to the point of killing his own citizens and destroying the infrastructure, and then they will come to the world community and beg for money to rebuild. Why destroy the infrastructure? Previously, again, if there was some disagreement between leaders, they would have a battle between the warrior class and the rest of the society would be left intact. In other words, their agricultural fields would still be there and the majority of the citizens would still be alive to pick up the pieces. But nowadays, it's just demoniac what they do. They just go in and wantonly kill and destroy. And then when things calm down a bit, oh, please give us money so we can rebuild. So that's not what was going on at the time of Pariksit. So the Brahmastra actually entered the womb of his mother and literally burned his body to pieces, the body of the child within the womb. But Krishna was there to protect him and regenerate, and he was saved. So because he was conscious of what happened and he saw Krishna, so he was always examining everyone that he met after he was born to see, is this the person that I saw within the womb? That's where he got the name Pariksit. Now, his own demise is imminent. He's getting ready to leave his body permanently, finally. And he's wondering what needs to be done. What should a person do in this position? So he asked his spiritual master, Shukadeva Goswami, what is the duty of a person who is about to die? And this whole Bhagavatam unfolded from that question. Now, interestingly, Shukadeva Goswami immediately gave the answer. If you see in the beginning of the second canto, he immediately gave the answer. Tasmat bharata sarvatma bhagavani shohari shotavya kirtatasvasya smartavya chetasa abhayam. He said, if you want to die fearlessly, then do the following. Tasmat bharata, or sign of bharata, sarvatma, the super soul, Bhagavan, the supreme personality, Ishvara, the controller, Hari, he who takes away everything, including the miseries of the devotees. Shrotavya kirtatavyascha, you must hear about him, chant about him, and meditate on him. Smartavya, you must meditate on him. So this is the answer right there. Yeah. No, that's the next time it's repeated. That verse is repeated twice. I was getting to that. You're jumping ahead of me, Bhrigupati. That just shows, though, he's hearing attentively. And it was such an important point that he made that he repeated the same thing almost verbatim, but just the last line is different. Tasmat bhartasarvasya bhagavani shrotavya kirtatavasya dhyaya puja cha nityada. Constantly, not just once in a while on Sunday or every time you're not feeling so well, all the time, constantly, one has to meditate upon Krishna. Hear about him, chant about him, remember him, meditate on him. So the answer was already given. This is what we all have to do because we're all about to die. Either by somebody wantonly pushing the button and the nuclear war starts, or by old age, disease. Everybody has to leave their body eventually. So this is really the perfection of advice for all of us. Hear about Krishna, chant about Krishna, remember Krishna, meditate on Krishna. That is the answer right there. But still he went on and gave all this detailed information, history of so many kings and the situation of the universe, the planets, how they're situated. Everything is described by the spiritual master. But still, even at this point, after so much description is taking place, Parikshit Maharaj is curious. He has questions. See? So this is an attentive student. Not that I'm feeling the pressure of death. Let's just talk about the rasa dance. No. He's curious about every little detail. He's listening attentively. So the question here is that this Agasura was killed during the Pauganda age. How is it that it's just being described now, practically a year later? So the answer will be given, we know. But the point I wanted to stress today was how to be a qualified disciple. By now, we've gotten to the 10th canto. We've seen examples of so many guru-disciple relationships. And those are there for us to meditate on because we're all either already disciples of a spiritual master or aspiring to become disciples of a spiritual master. So we have to take it seriously. What does it mean to be a disciple? It cannot be taken lightly. What does it mean to be a disciple? Prabhupada gives the answer many, many places, but in one place he stressed that disciple means discipline. Disciple means that you voluntarily submitted yourself to a spiritual master, a guide, spiritual guide, to be disciplined in how to go forward in spiritual life. So if one does not want to accept discipline, then one should not become a disciple. It becomes a disturbance. Just like if you don't want to study, if you don't want to be a student, then why go to a particular school? Especially when we get into the higher levels of education. In the lower levels, it's mandatory. You must go to elementary school. You must. It's mandatory. But beyond that, it becomes elective. It's up to you if you go to college, university. So if you decide to go, then why go for the wrong reason? These institutions of learning are established for particular reasons. And if you're not in line with that reason, then why go there? Why go to college to sell drugs? Which a lot of people do. I'm reading now Chasing Rhinos with the Swami, Shyamasundara's book. First volume finally came out. I prepaid months and months ago and waiting. So finally came in the mail the other day. So he mentioned about himself, and it's true probably of many of us from that era, late 60s, mid to late 60s, that he went to college to sell drugs. That's what he went to college for, and he made good money. He made good money doing it. But one day, he went home to his apartment, and the police were waiting. They handcuffed him and took him to jail. So he mentioned there that While he was in jail, he literally prayed to God that if you get me out of this, I will search after you until I find you. So that was his promise to God in jail. And after he got out, Krishna made sure he kept that promise. His good friend Michael, who became Mukunda Maharaj, had gone to New York, taken initiation from Srila Prabhupada. He came back to the West Coast and introduced Sam, his good friend Sam, to the Swami's teachings. And that was Krishna revealing to him, you want to find me, you have to accept a spiritual guide. You cannot come to me directly. We cannot go to God directly. We need a spiritual guide. We have to become disciples of such a qualified spiritual guide, which means we present ourselves to be disciplined by that guide. It's like Bhakti Churu Maharaj was saying last night in his presentation, that Prabhupada's mood is different depending on who he was dealing with. When he was dealing with his disciples, he was heavy. And he would really chew them out sometimes, because that's what was required. You know, he was still dealing with totally unqualified personalities who are not really interested in the ultimate goal of life, who are not interested in being disciplined. So you have to take such Kali Yuga denizens and try to train them to become perfect Brahmanas, Vaishnavas. So you have to get heavy in that pursuit. Nowadays it's not so fashionable anymore for the guru to be heavy. So many reasons for that, because we went through the aftermath of so many gurus leaving, falling down, and therefore those who remain, literally they had to start begging. And Prabhupada even said that in Kali Yuga, the spiritual master has to go out and canvass. He said previously the spiritual master would sit down, and those who were qualified looking for guidance in spiritual life, they would go searching for a qualified guru, and they would meet the spiritual master, and the relationship would be established. But he said now in Kali Yuga, who wants a qualified guru? Who wants a guru? Nobody wants. Therefore the spiritual master has to canvass. He has to go out. Please chant Hare Krishna. Please follow these principles. Please allow me to guide you back to Godhead. You see? Previously, this was not the case. We don't see that Vyasadeva was canvassing door to door for disciples. No. But disciples approached him. And so this was the previous way. But now in Kali Yuga, nobody's really interested. So the spiritually qualified leaders, they have to go out and canvass. Please chant Hare Krishna. Please follow these principles. Please allow me to guide you back to Godhead. So but Prabhupada, we see, you know, when he was dealing with his disciples, he was heavy. Guru means heavy. So he was heavy. Because practically speaking, again, we didn't want the real goal of spiritual life. We just wanted a guru because it was a fashion at that time. Everybody was taking a guru, this guru, that guru. So many of us took for that reason. Or out of curiosity, as Krishna says, Chaturvedabhidhante mam jana sukritana arjita artha jigyasu artharti gyanicha bharatarjava. Some of them are in distress, some are in need of money, some are just curious, and very few approach because they're really in knowledge and understand that I need, for my benefit, a spiritual guide to take me back to Godhead. The problem with being in the other three categories is that when the distress is mitigated, when money starts to flow, when my curiosity is more or less satisfied, then I again want to go out into the material realm to enjoy, to try to control, to enjoy. But one who has submitted him or herself to be disciplined becomes convinced very quickly that there is no enjoyment in this material world. There's no possibility of my becoming the supreme controller. I'm not even really the minor controller that I seem to be, because that control can be taken away at any moment. Not just can be, will be taken away. I may be in control of my, supposedly in control of my family or business or a community or a city or a country, but that's just temporary. We've seen, all of us at our age, so many controllers come and go, so many leaders come and go. Sometimes voluntarily they go and other times they get dragged down, just like has happened in so many countries recently. In Libya, for so many decades, this Gaddafi was synonymous with Libya. It was his country. He did whatever he wanted with it. But finally, his own countrymen dragged him down in a very embarrassing way. We don't have to give the details. You can find out for yourself. But the way he was dispatched with was very, very horrible. So after many, many decades of being a leader and himself dispatching of so many people at his will, I don't like such and such person, kill him. Boom, that person is dead. Now he himself was dragged down and killed. So the so-called control that we achieve in the material world is temporary, precarious, not meaningful ultimately. Ultimately, there's only one supreme controller, Ishvara Parama Krishna. That's it. And whoever Krishna designates or allows to be a controller for some period of time, they can assume that position. But ultimately, they have to give it up. Even Parikshit himself, we see, he was the emperor of the world. But because of one error in judgment, offending a sage, his rulership came to an end at a very young age. Prabhupada said he could have resisted, he could have fought, but he saw the handwriting on the wall literally that it was Krishna's arrangement so that this pastime of meeting a spiritual master, Shukadeva Goswami, could take place and the Bhagavatam could be spoken for the benefit of everyone. So here he's asking again a relevant question, but the main thing is that he's setting the proper mood of a disciple. One has to hear attentively. This is the beginning of being a good disciple. If one hears attentively from the spiritual master, qualified spiritual master, then one will act appropriately. One will be able to speak properly, and one will also be able to act properly. It all begins with proper hearing. But it takes time to hear properly. It takes time. We have to be trained in how to hear. Because we're, generally speaking, hearing through the illusions that have been established in our consciousness over lifetime after lifetime. This is what, when we hear something, it becomes filtered through those illusions. And we literally hear what we want to hear and discard what we don't want to hear. It's our personal knowledge filter. Just like Dr. Karma and Sariputta established that in the science community, they have this knowledge filter. They make a theory, like Darwin's theory, and then they go out in the world and examine the world, and anything that fits the theory, they hold on to, and anything that doesn't fit the theory, they filter out, put to the side, discard it, or put it away, because it doesn't match the theory. So similarly, we all have our built-in knowledge filter. And therefore we hear even transcendental knowledge according to that filter. And therefore you see constantly people will take Srila Prabhupada's books or some other scripture to prove some point which is just the opposite of the point that somebody else is trying to make based on the same scripture. And therefore who is it that said, we both read the Bible day and night, I see black and you see white. Yeah, Blake, yeah. So again, in every tradition, that's not just in our tradition or in the Christian tradition, in every tradition, based on one's own knowledge filter, one's going to hear and accept what wants, even from the scriptures. Even from Prabhupada's writings, people try to establish different opposing points, like the whole Rigvedic philosophy. Some people will read Prabhupada's books and conversations and come to the conclusion that that's okay, and others will rightfully say, no, that's not what Prabhupada wanted. That's not what went on previously, and it's not what's supposed to go on now. So we have to be trained how to hear properly. The quality of our hearing will be determined by the quality of our practice, because that quality of spiritual practice will gradually clear away the illusion. And we will be brought back to our normal, clear consciousness where we can hear everything clearly and therefore repeat it clearly and practice spiritual life properly and pass it on properly, which is what we're meant to do. Prabhupada has established exactly what he wants his society to do. Now, the current members of the society, if they have heard properly, will pass it on exactly the way Prabhupada gave it to us. We're not at liberty to censor Prabhupada, to change what Prabhupada has given. We don't have that liberty. We don't have that liberty. So we have to accept Prabhupada in toto. It has become fashionable, unfortunately, to call oneself a follower of Prabhupada, even a disciple of Srila Prabhupada, but as soon as you come up with this but, you're hit the buzzer, you're disqualified. There is no but. There is no but. Srila Prabhupada is the qualified spiritual master to lead all of us back to Godhead, and we don't have the right, the position. That means you're putting yourself in a position above Prabhupada. If you think you're going to read Prabhupada's books and accept what you want and discard what you don't want, then you've put yourself in a position to judge Prabhupada. That means you're above Prabhupada. Is there anybody who would openly admit that? But by their actions, they're giving that indication. Why did Prabhupada say this? Why did he do that? Why? Who are you to question? If you've accepted, based on incontrovertible evidence, that Prabhupada is a pure devotee of Krishna, then you don't have any right after that. You have to follow, just like Sukadev Goswami is following Maharaj Pariksit. He's inquiring whatever answer he gets. If it's not clear, he will inquire further, but once it's clear, then that's it. That's it. You can't question. Again, it's like questioning Krishna. Why did Krishna tell Arjuna to kill Karna when he was unarmed? Why did he tell you to steer the lie? Why? We question even God, as if we're greater than God. We're bigger moralists than Krishna. No, Krishna is the supreme. Whatever conclusion he comes to, that's the right conclusion. So his telling Arjuna to kill Karna is correct. That's what was required. We can't question Krishna. And similarly, you can't question Krishna's representative. So if we accept Srila Prabhupada as a pure representative of Krishna, then we can't question, why did he say that? Why did he? No. We simply accept and follow. Yes, then someone will say, well, Prabhupada himself said, don't follow blindly. Yeah, don't follow blindly, but once you've accepted the person as being a pure representative, then you have to follow. And you can't question anymore. It's not that forever you're able to question and take what you want and leave it. No, then again, you're putting yourself in a position higher than Prabhupada. You're not following, you're leading. You're leading Prabhupada. Why did you say that? You shouldn't have said that. Let me take this out of your book. I don't like it. And I don't think it will fly in today's society. People are not going to be... Who are you? You accept what Prabhupada said. You came. Why do you think that nobody else will come? You read the same books and you're here. Why do you think they won't come? You think that you're something special, better than everybody else? No. No. It's by Prabhupada's mercy that we're here. And that mercy is still available for everyone. In spite of whatever you think is in the books that doesn't sound right to you. But in spite of that, you came. So that mercy is there for everybody else, and they'll come if they're ready, when they're ready. And whatever portion they come in contact with, they will benefit from. So we have to be in this mood of Pariksit, Maharaj. In the next verse, I actually was going to read that, but I'll leave it for the next speaker. But in that purport, Prabhupada refers to Pariksit's qualities as being submissive and humble. In spite of being the emperor of the world, because he's a devotee, he's submissive and he's humble. So we have to judge our own consciousness by those two qualities. Are we being submissive to Srila Prabhupada, and are we approaching him in a humble mood? Or are we like some current so-called followers, putting ourselves in a position where we can judge Prabhupada? Why did he say this? Why did he do? Why? That means you're not understanding what your relationship with Prabhupada is. We are supposed to be, our whole line is this presentation of servant of the servant of the servant. And I'll end here. There's that nice verse. It actually appears in the Mukunda Mala Stotra. This is spoken by Kulashekhar Maharaj. Kulashekhar. It says, Maj Janmanam Manaranam Madhukaitavane Mat Pratani Manunuja Eva Esha Brityasa Britta Paricharya Ka Britta Brityas Brityasa Britta Itimang Smara Lokanata. So he's praying to Krishna. My dear Lord, the enemy of Madhu and Kaitav, the perfection of my life and the highest benediction that you can give me is to think of me as the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant of your servant. Seven times repeated. Now this is verse number 25. So this wasn't, the purport is not by Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada started the Mukunda Mala Stotra, but he stopped after text 13, I think. And the rest of it was done by his disciples, headed by Satsuru Maharaj. The purports were written by him. Translations were done by, I think, Gopi Purananda. But still, the verse itself is pretty clear, even if you don't accept a purport written by a disciple of Srila Prabhupada. The verse itself is pretty clear. And this is what we should be aspiring for. We should aspire to be remembered by Krishna, thought of by Krishna, as the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant. However, in that purport, Satsuru Maharaj makes a very good point. That even when you get back to the spiritual world, the manjaris, they are assisting other assistants of Srimati Radharani. And Srimati Radharani is thinking that they are enjoying a higher happiness by assisting my assistants than I am enjoying. So this is the spiritual world.
Everybody is assisting somebody in the service of Radha and Krishna. And the assistants are enjoying apparently more pleasure than the people they're assisting. Just like Maharaj mentioned last night, that one of the reasons for Krishna appearing as Lord Chaitanya is to taste the happiness that Radharani tastes in serving him and being his devotee. So this is our motivation. We want to taste the happiness of being a servant of the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant. Not that we want to be the boss. Not that we want to be the direct servant of Radha Krishna. We want to taste that happiness of being a servant of Srila Prabhupada, of being a servant of Srila Prabhupada's servant. That's the happiness that we want to taste. And we can only taste that if we approach Srila Prabhupada submissively and humbly. Not that, again, we puff ourselves up to think that we can censor Prabhupada and judge Prabhupada and change what Prabhupada gave. We don't have that liberty. So I'll stop here. Any questions or comments? I want to see if anybody else before, because Brigapati is always number one and he always has something good, but I want to give some, and you two, you're always up there. Let's give Mataji a chance to kick it off the questions today. Mother Karuna Dharani, where is the microphone? By the way, I forgot to extend a special welcome to our student from Chapman University. What is your name? Sam. And his mother's here also. Thank you very much for visiting and participating in our... This is our daily function, by the way, greeting the deities and hearing from the scriptures. So you're welcome to come any day. We love to have visitors every day. Yes, Mother Karuna Dharani, what is your question?
From reading Prabhupada's books, I can understand he understood a great deal more than we all do about why we should be nonviolent and why we should not harm animals. But sometimes a devotee will say, who's leaning towards veganism, a devotee will say, well, Prabhupada didn't understand the atrocities of modern-day slaughterhouses. And then, from reading Prabhupada's books, you can understand that that's not true at all, because he understood on a much deeper level than we do. He wasn't about health concerns and about, So I was wondering if you could say something about that.
I've said so many times that a devotee of Krishna, devotee coming in our line, cannot be a vegan. You may be a ahimsa vegetarian, that you only take milk products from protected cows. That's okay. But you can't be a vegan. Why would you want to go back to Goloka, where Krishna is maintaining cows, if you're a vegan? They take oceans of milk from the Kamadhenus, and they make so many milk products. It's all mentioned. Bhaktivinoda Thakura's song, the Bogartik song, What Krishna Eats, Luchitini Sarpuri, Ladu, all these preparations, and most of them are made with milk. So you can't be a devotee in our line and be a vegan. It's not possible. A vegan means somebody who doesn't think it's right, it's immoral, they think it's immoral to use any product from animals, even up to and including honey, those who are really strict vegans. You can't take any animal product for human conception. That's real vegan. And I remember in San Diego, they just had their Rath Yatra on Earth Day just last weekend. But about, this was maybe mid-90s, same thing, we had Rath Yatra Earth Day in Balboa Park. And a bunch of vegans descended on our camp, hardcore vegans. And they came with the desire to smash us. You're Hare Krishnas, you're preaching God consciousness, this, but you're taking animal products and this is immoral. And they really got into it, and some devotees were really getting into it then. And then finally, Dhyanamita Maharaj came over and said, just don't bother, because you'll never change your minds. You cannot change. It's counterproductive to argue with people like that. You'll never change your minds, and they're not going to change our minds. So that we established that. You can't be a devotee in our line and be a vegan. So then, yes, ahimsa vegetarianism is okay. So one may say, well, then why do we still take milk from non-protected cows? Why did Prabhupada set that example? Again, if it's available in the marketplace, if you can find milk from protected cows, take it and use it in the deity worship. But if not, Prabhupada showed that milk products are so important, and even if it's not available, ahimsa milk, take the regular milk. Because the cows that produce that milk will benefit. You can't get milk from a dead cow. You cannot get milk from a dead cow. So if you have milk, it came from a live cow. And that cow, even if she was later slaughtered, that milk that you've used in her in Christian service, it will benefit her. She gets a benefit from her milk being used in Christian service. So we should try, obviously, our best to get ahimsa milk wherever it's available. But if it's not available, prophets show the example that it's more important to take the milk, even the milk from the slaughterhouse society, and use it in Christian service, and that animal who gave that milk is benefited, and you benefit. Milk, even this tainted milk, is better for you than no milk at all.
My question, that's very, I understand that, but my question is more specifically is when we put ourselves in a position of thinking that Prabhupada was somehow rather ignorant of a modern day phenomenon and that's why he wasn't able to address it properly.
That's not true. Prabhupada obviously knew. He spoke so much about the slaughterhouse culture that we're living in. He was even opposed to cutting trees unnecessarily. Rather than killing a tree, you should be killed, Prabhupada said. He was even against killing trees, what to speak of killing cows. And he was completely aware. He was completely aware of what goes on. That just shows you how important it was to him to have milk in his diet and being offered to the deities. It was so important to him that even those coming out of that slaughterhouse society, milk is such an important food. Such an important food. Prabhupada said that children should be given milk, 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 and they should take it as hot as they can take it. He said once, not cold milk. Like I grew up drinking milk, but I was chugging cold milk straight from the refrigerator. But that's not good. Prabhupada said our children should be given hot as they can take it, because hot milk is more beneficial for the brain. So milk is brain food and such miracle food. Prabhupada wanted us to take it, and our culture, spiritual culture coming down, is to take milk. Again, Prabhupada also wanted us to establish farm communities, and like he started when he was here, like Itanagari and, you know, New Vrindavan. He wanted that for sure. But for the city-bound devotees, if they can't get ahimsa milk, it's better to take the regular milk and offer it to Krishna, and it benefits your body. Even that milk benefits your body, what to speak of if you can get ahimsa milk. Okay, Brigapati Prabhu. Quickly, we're running out of time.
So you mentioned Yuklesa Maharaj, he was cursed, but he was powerful. He could have counteracted the curse, but he accepted it. Okay, so my question is this. How do you know when you're supposed to do, like, follow in the footsteps of Maharaj Prickett and just accept something which is, you know, it's wrong, it's unjust, what's been done to you? And when are you supposed to fight back against it? Like, for instance, in Bhagavad Gita, and I think it's chapter 1, text 36 in the purport, Prabhupada says there are six kinds, he says it's a Vedic injunction, there are six kinds of aggressors that can be killed immediately. One who gives poison, one who sets fire, one who steals your wife, blah, blah, blah. And then even earlier, and later, in the second chapter, it says, happy are the Kshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought. So in other words, it seems like there's a time when it's appropriate to not take things lying down. But it seems like there's a time when it's appropriate to just take it, okay, well, I guess this is Krishna's arrangement, and I should just see it as Krishna's mercy, and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I mean, it's pretty obvious from this comparison. Parikshit Maharaj saw this as a reaction to his unjust act. He garlanded this sage with a dead snake. It should not have been done. And it's mentioned, Prabhupada mentions, that the Kshatriyas are never meant to rule the Brahmanas. Kshatriyas, you may have your Ishwara Bhava, you may have that controlling tendency, but they're not supposed to use it on the Brahmanas. They're supposed to be advised by the Brahmanas. Yep. So for a Kshatriya to insult a Brahmana like that, so Parikshit saw it as his just reward. He didn't think it was unfair, in other words.
That was his
humility. It may have been extreme, the reaction may have been extreme, but he didn't see it as being unwarranted. He knew he did something that wasn't right. Now, if you're in a position where you are being attacked, as you said, there are six kinds of aggressors, that yes, you can defend yourself. You can definitely defend yourself. But the devotee, first of all, examines to see, is it something that is that I deserve? Is it? Because the devotee is always examining. Did I offend this person? Just like that famous story of Prabhupada in Toronto, I believe it was. And it was one of the Canadian cities. I think it was Toronto. Where this Indian man had come to see Prabhupada to take darshan. But at the end, he was actually insulting Prabhupada, and he got into shouting match, and he would, you know. So the devotees were ready to throw him out, but Prabhupada was still keeping him. And finally the man left, and the devotees were like, shh. But then Prabhupada said, did anybody get his contact information? And the devotees were flabbergasted. Contact information? Prabhupada, this guy insulted you. You don't want to see him again. Prabhupada said, no, I may have offended him in a previous life. You see, that was Prabhupada's mood. I may have offended him in a previous life. Prabhupada didn't take it so seriously. So this is always the mood of the devotee. If something is happening to me, my first reaction is that I think somewhere I deserve it. Either from this life or a previous life, I did something, I'm getting my just rewards. So let me tolerate. So the first mood of the devotee is to tolerate, not to immediately lash out. You see, we don't want to immediately lash out. We want to be an introspective, see maybe this is coming, something I deserve. And let me press on in spite of that. Now, if it becomes obvious that this person is attacking unjustly, just like in Juhu, then Prabhupada is ready to fight on the behalf of the deity. He wasn't fighting on behalf of his own integrity or reputation. But the deity has been established here. We cannot allow them to come and take, knock down, fight. And even some devotees were ready to give up. Giriraj Maharaj tells a story. You can talk to him. The devotees were at the point where they were ready to give up. Prabhupada is just, we're not going to win here. It's a losing proposition. No, Prabhupada, fight. On behalf of the deities, you must fight, and you prevail eventually. So this is our mood. For ourselves, we're not so eager to retaliate, and let me at least first of all examine to see maybe I'm getting just reaction here. But if it turns out that it's unjust, and especially after consulting with higher authorities, the word is fight, then you fight. Even Arjuna wanted to give up, even though it was obvious the Kauravas were wrong. They were the aggressors. He wanted to give up and go to the forest. I'm not going to enjoy the kingdom anyway, even if I win, because it's going to be tainted with blood. So many arguments he gave, But Krishna wanted it, so let me do it. So the devotee, first reaction is to be introspective, back off, maybe I deserve this. But if the order especially comes from higher authorities, from Krishna or Krishna's representative, fight, then you fight. Tooth and nail. Jai. Granth Sarva Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Bhaktivrinda ki jai.
Hare Krishna. All right.